wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Hi there. This week's episode is with comic book artist Martin Geraghty, well known for his many years working on the main strip for Doctor Who magazine. He's currently part of the Cutaway Comics team and provided brilliant art for Demons of Eden, written by me, and is just finishing up Faustine, Princess of Tharol, from the pen of Stephen Gallagher, which will be published very soon. The interview took place in Martin's kitchen, which has a tiled floor, something you'll hear Martin's dog, Indiana, scrabbling about on. There may also be barking.
So, welcome to The Bunker, Martin Geraghty.
Hello.
And Indiana, your little dog.
Well, we hope he's going to behave himself.
Well, we've introduced him because he's a noisy bugger. With his scrabbly paws. So, so we're in the bunker with your 5 choices. Before we get into the choices, obviously you can, you don't have to tell me your exact age, although it's all over the internet if anyone wants to look. So, obviously Doctor Who plays quite a huge part in your life because it's what a lot of people know you for, in terms of your actual career as a comic book artist. So how did it come into your life in childhood, I suppose? What are your earliest Who memories?
It is season 11, I think, which was the last John Pertwee season. Although I've got a memory of watching The Sea Devils, which was earlier, but must have been a repeat. So I think The Sea Devils. But my memory is of season 11 and Lynx taking his helmet off at the end of part one, and the ghost of Agador, that statue of Agador, floating about the mines of Peladon, and the spiders, which have given me a lifelong phobia of spiders, so thanks for that. I know it's a cliche that you watch it from behind the sofa as a kid, but I don't know how true that is, really, but I do genuinely remember scuttling under my dad's chair when, at the end of episode one of The Time Warrior, when Lynx took his helmet off, and that absolutely freaked me out.
Yeah.
For a week, you know, after that, it was like, and I was only, how old was I? Five at the oldest, I think.
Yeah.
So it did, all those kind of images from season 11 are seared into my memory. And it was kind of a shame that they were, it's almost a shame that they came out on video and DVD so that I could relive them. Because the memory of them is kind of more, it's stronger than actually reviewing them again now.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're sort of, maybe as fans, we're always chasing that first experience.
Yeah,
and it's never
like that hit.
But I remember the first time I watched a VHS, and I got to have the Zygons out, so I'm a little bit younger than you. So that was my Madeleine cake.
Yeah.
Twisty in terms. And I do remember the rush of seeing the Doctor Who, that era's titles.
Yeah.
Oh, which I don't think, in my head, strangely, the titles have never been better than during that era of Doctor Who. I do remember the absolute Proustian rush of, oh my God, I'm flashing back to childhood. Nowadays, I guess, everything's a lot more.
Well, it's immediate.
You can gratification. You just go onto YouTube and relive your childhood. So people are reliving their childhood from while they're still in their childhood. But we did have that big gap, didn't we?
Well, I must have worn out my Pyramids of Mars VHS.
Yeah.
Which I think at the time, and the Revenge of the Cybermen, which were like 30-odd quid in the early to mid-80s. or mid to late 80s, 30 quid wasn't, you know, it wasn't an amount of money to be sniffed at. I think I only had a paper round. Mm-hmm. So I must have been saving up for weeks to, I mean, I had to order it from WH Smith's.
Yeah.
You couldn't just buy it off the shelf. I had to get to WH Smith's and order Revenge of the Sideman and Pyramids of Mars and Seeds of Death and all those.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God the prices have come down. Now, when you compare how much you pay now for a season box set, Blu-ray with all the VAM,
mm-hmm.
compared to one clunky VHS, 30-odd quid.
Yeah.
Over 30 quid. Nearly 40 quid I paid for Revenge of the Sideman, which is crazy.
It's
not even that good.
I was not given enough pocket money to access. I didn't access them till I went to university. I was suddenly at university feeling homesick, and it was like, that's when I suddenly went, oh, I might sneak out and buy a Doctor Who VHS.
Yeah, let's give that a go.
And that was where I started buying them.
And they've all been chucked out. All my VHS, I had a library of VHS, not just Doctor Who, just everything going that I could pick my hands on. Raiders of the Lost Ark, Fawlty Towers, all, you know, loads and loads of VHS films, The Prisoner, all landfill now. It's all had to go because, you know, you can't get rid of these things for love nor money.
No, I've got DVDs. So,
buried away. I know you can't even take a DVD to the charity shop now.
Can you not?
No DVDs, it says.
Oh my God. Yeah, they're 5 for a quid in my local charity shop there.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh.
That's pretty good.
I've started buying lots of DVDs to go past.
Anyway. Having a look.
Yeah. Anyway, so in terms of the order of things, so like you said, your first memories are of Pertwee, your first Doctor Who memories of a Pertwee. So the oldest choice on your list is from one you don't really remember, is Inferno.
Yes.
So what's your relationship with Inferno? The wonderful, I think it's lots of people's favourite Doctor Who of all time, and I think it's particularly good for cutaway because we've got Gary Russell scripting the sort of his take on what happened after the Doctor left, and you're doing the art on that, aren't you?
Yeah, he's doing a prequel and a global sequel, which
I know, three books of,
sounds amazing.
Yeah, well, both you and I have read the first sort of prequel with Winston Churchill,
yeah,
and all that sort of stuff.
It's all very nicely plotted out and makes sense of what we see in the TV series.
Yeah,
as you'd expect from Gary.
Yeah. Technically, I'm the editor on that, but, you know, I don't know if I should even have a name on there, because I'm just going, I have read it, it's fine.
Yeah, well, we need it's good. It's fine. No, don't worry about it. Gary won't object.
No.
So in Inferno, I think the first, other than seeing pics of the rather silly-looking Primords, although when you see them on screen, they are quite scary. But actually more scary when they're not fully grown, you know, Alsatian people. They're kind of scarier when they've just gone grey and a bit snarly. But, you know, they needed a monster. And so other than the kind of synopsis and the photographs in DWM, or Doctor Who Weekly, as probably was when it was when I first saw the pics, I got the Target paperback with the really nice cover by Andrew Skeletor, and read that. I think I got it for Christmas when it came out, and I read it in one sitting and thought, wow, this is great. It's a classic, even though it's 7 episodes, I think it's a classic 10 sticks cut down. It's really lean and it's just a really nice rapid read. And then obviously I got the VHS, the double pack VHS. Excuse the dog.
There's Indiana. On the floor. You sit there.
Yeah, and I was blown away by the VHS. It was tense. Obviously, Dougie Canfield, although he didn't finish directing it, I think Barry Letts took over the reins and Dougie Canfield was ill. I think, obviously, it's got the hallmark of Douglas Canfield all over it rather than Barry Letts, I think. And it's just blissful. And that kind of swerve away from, you know, into the parallel world is inspired. It's another way of extending the 7-part structure, and it's really cleverly done. And of course, you know, in that world, in that parallel world, no one survives. They're just, you know, they're gone. which yeah. is quite terrifying. I mean,
well, that's Gary's main thing, is to say the Doctor got it slightly wrong.
Yeah.
In that, I think the Doctor in Inferno says when he gets back to our world, have they got like 4 weeks to go?
Yeah, something like yeah. That's yeah, right.
And so Gary's conceit is the Doctor was wrong, but only by a matter of months. So yeah. This is kind of like the world's ending with a whimper.
Yes, yeah.
The Earth Dies Screaming was one of his alternative titles.
That's right. I thought it was a bit long.
Yeah,
for the comic cover.
Yeah,
but
brilliant. The all the political
yeah,
blocks of the
really...
China, Europe, America. What? How they're all acting?
Yeah, how they'd react to it.
Yeah,
obviously they'd batten down the hatches. I think I think it'd be every man for himself in that situation.
Yeah, yeah, but that's something we're all very much looking forward to. Obviously, one of the things in Inferno, and you've had to draw, is the sort of Big Brother character.
Oh yes,
who was. Oh, what's going on?
He was Jack Kine, I think his name was. He was the visual effects
supervisor
at the BBC.
Yeah, yeah. And he's already quite established. He's obviously someone who, that sort of era, that's something Gary's also going to explore. Because there's been sort of hints of him before, like the new adventures and stuff. That sort of making him a sort of ally of Oswald Mosley.
That's right, yeah.
And Gary sort of touches on that as well. But yeah, that poster when we revealed it at Gallifrey 1, that you drew, just looks absolutely brilliant.
I'd actually forgotten I'd done it.
Yeah,
I've got a big printout of it done, a big A1 printout of it done that's rolled up in back room, actually. I was going to...
Oh, wow.
Kind of framed and printed up somewhere at some point. But then I thought, I was going to have it in me house, and then I thought... People come in, I'm just going to think I'm a Nazi, like that episode of Father Ted.
Martin, I hear you're a racist
you're
now.
You're a racist now, are you, Martin? yeah, that was... I like doing that kind of mock beating up. I like the imagery of fascism. I think there's a strength to it and a scariness to it, which attracts artists and creatives.
Yeah, well, the same with communist art.
Yeah.
It looks amazing.
I'd rather
they know what they're doing.
I'd rather get a book of communist and fascist propaganda art than a book on Monet and Renoir. You know, there's just a huge dynamism and strength to it. And it's very comic book as well. It's a very comic book graphic style to it.
Yeah.
So that was fun to do, and I definitely wanted the kind of leader image in the middle and to make it like the colours of the Third Reich and what have you, because it's scary. He's a scary person if he even exists, which I presume we're going to find out that he does in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just some kind of figurehead that's
like Big Brother in 1984,
who's very much based on, obviously.
But
it was nice and kind of scorching the edges and creating that kind of verite sort of in-universe, you know, magazine or poster that exists in the actual story, as opposed to just illustrating the story as it's going to appear.
In terms of Inferno, it's very dark and dystopian. I mean, to destroy an entire world, even if it's a parallel world, it basically says everybody on this parallel world is dead.
Yeah.
And is going to die.
In a nice way. One of the last things I'd want to see before my death is a massive lake of lava rolling towards me. I mean, that's going to hurt, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
not going to be nice.
No, it's...
I love the cliffhanger to... I think it's episode 5, where the countdown's going on and Pertwee's got the gun pulled on him by Stalman.
Yeah.
And it's just the pan in on Pertwee's face as he's realising the game's up. It's just superbly done.
Yeah,
and the reality of the locations, you know, the refinery, it all looks really gritty and grim and nasty. It's just season 7, I think, is probably my favourite Pertwee season. It's just, every story in it is absolutely superb.
Well, I think Pertwee's era as a whole is absolutely solid.
Yeah. Oh, it really is.
Absolutely. For a Tom Baker era kids like me, it's something to discover and go, there's a reason everyone loved it when Tom Baker came along.
What a great team Barry and Terence were
yeah, yeah.
working all the way through that. I mean, 5 seasons of it. And I mean, season 11 is running slightly on empty, but it's still full of great images, great ideas, you know, action set pieces, you know, creating, even then creating iconic monsters. So, yes, and Pertwee is, like I said, I only remember watching from season 11, so the bulk of it, you know, four-fifths of it, I've not discovered at all, but reading the Target novelisations and the first Doctor Who monster book, you know, it just whet the appetite for what was to come, you know, when we got DVDs and VHSs of it. Very rarely disappointed.
No, it's amazing. And also, I think one revelation from that season as well to people discovering that era is Caroline John as Liz Shaw. And, you know, we were cheated out of. Nothing against Katie Manning, because she's wonderful as well.
Yeah.
But Liz Shaw is just such a brilliant companion.
And they
decided, oh, actually, we shouldn't have given Doctor a scientist.
Yeah.
A clever lady doesn't suit.
They did exactly the same thing a couple of years later with Romana. But
I think Romana is badly designed in a way that Liz Shaw isn't. Mm. Romana is badly designed in that she's a Time Lord.
Yes.
You know, so she just knows way too much. So whenever she's like, Doctor, explain this to me, like, you're a Time Lord. Yeah. You've been through the Academy. And you've apparently got better grades than the Doctor. Here comes the crazy dog.
It's a shame that Caroline John didn't even get a decent send off. She's just in between.
Well, this is her last seat. This is her last
to Cambridge.
Yeah, this is her last story, isn't it? And she's in a parallel universe for a lot of it, and it really brings home. I mean, I just for this podcast, I had to rewatch Spearhead from Space for the first time in I've worked out since 1992, and I didn't really appreciate it at the time because you're not really watching in that way. But just my God, she just hits the ground running as a brilliant actor.
Yeah,
absolutely brilliant. Her and Pertwee are perfect.
She's really good. She's one of these one season and done companions who you kind of miss. You know, she should have had at least another half season, and, you know, and then have Katie come in sort of as a strong contrast.
Yeah.
In that first season, she's a really good foil to Pertwee's Doctor.
And she's brilliant because she's got just the right amount of knowledge, but she's also, it's almost like Mulder and Scully in a way, because she's the sceptic and he's the one who's like, no, it's crazy aliens.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so it kind of works.
I think she'd have been good.
She's science versus his science fiction.
Yes. She'd have kind of worked well in, I mean, I know Joe works well in The Demons, but I think Liz and the Doctor in The Demons would have been a good pairing as well.
She wouldn't have believed anything.
Yeah.
And it's one of the great what ifs, but and obviously she died quite a while ago, but luckily she for years she thought she was kind of sacked. They didn't rate her as an actor, but she at least found out that wasn't the case at all.
Yeah.
They just sort of thought, maybe we've not quite got this companion right on the page as a foil for the Doctor, which I think maybe they should just worked a bit harder. Because she was good as a feminist icon, in that people were always going, oh, you're a lady. And you know all this stuff. So it was good in that way as well. So I think she was a brilliant companion. But as an evil Nazi in parallel Britain, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, her being stronger than the brigade leader at the end is a really nice twist. It's a nice turnaround. She ends up mocking him because he becomes that craven by the end of it.
Yeah,
you know, the classic bully who's faced with his own demise and just bottles it. Is mocking him in the room, you know, and there's no comeback.
Yeah.
It's a really, I mean, you can imagine, you can see why the cast liked that story so much.
Yeah.
Actually making it, because it allowed them to put a nice twist on their own established characters, even though, to be honest, the Brigadier wasn't that well established by, I mean, he'd only been in a few stories. It took, you know, I think by season 12 is when he kind of becomes a Brigadier we know and love.
Yeah, but I
suppose a bit sillier than he should have been towards the end of it.
Maybe
I liked his more officious character in the first.
Well, I suppose the impact of the brigade leader is even greater as the years go by.
Yeah.
Because now people presumably watch Inferno and they've seen the brigadier, you know, go through everything and die, and then and then come back as a sideman, which we didn't talk about.
Yeah, that's a bad idea. Such a bad idea.
I do not like that.
No, that's just what.
that's not good. That's not good for his legacy.
Setting stories going around bazookaing him, you know, invasion, and then he ends up being one. It's just
the worst. The worst.
Got
but anyway,
excised.
We
someone's got to write something that just excises that, and it's a mistake.
I know, as old men grumbling about about the new Doctor Who, but so Inferno, absolutely perfect.
Warp Warp, the near legendary Doctor Who fanzine, is back for its 5th issue. As always, it's a sumptuous, glossy, gorgeous feast of goodness, featuring in-depth articles on all manner of Who-related expanded media. Artist John Ridgway and writer Steve Parkhouse discuss their classic 6th Doctor comic strip, Voyager. And writer Alan Stevens takes us through the history of one of Marvel UK's most popular Whoniverse creations, Absalom Dak, Dalek Killer. There are 2 all-colour comic strips too, exclusively commissioned for Warp Warp. The Iron Legion returns in a 22-page story written by Lance Parkin and illustrated by Steve Andrew, this time pitting the rampaging Roman robots against the 12th Doctor, while Absalom Dak gets another adventure with the mighty John Ridgway on our duties.
Hey, Chainsaw Silversides!
On top of all of that, there's the full story of how Canadian animation studio Nelvana came very close to making an animated version of Doctor Who in the 1990s. As well as interviews with the project's key creatives, we've recorded the pilot script as an audio drama. Accompanying the magazine as a cover-mounted CD, it stars British sitcom legend Arthur Bostrom as the Doctor.
Endless vast wastelands, distant nothingness stretching as far as the eye can see. Not very inviting. Could be Milton Keynes. No, the stars are all wrong. Very wrong indeed.
Continuing our dedication to the printed form, Warp Warp 5 is only available as a physical copy and can be ordered from anywhere in the world for the UK price of £10.99 plus shipping. For more information and to place an order, visit warpwarp.co.uk. The link in this episode's notes will take you straight to the shop. Or, for our overseas readers going to Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles in February, the Cutaway Comics team will be there with piles of Warp Warp 5s for sale, as well as all our other comic book lines. So, see you in the dealer's room. And the bar.
So, we'll come on later to sort of talk about how you got into actually the creative side, you know, earning money from Doctor Who and, you know, establishing a massive career through Doctor Who. But I guess next, I take it you've got two stories that are quite, well, I guess the next 3 TV stories are all Tom Baker.
Mm.
So I guess we'll sort of do them in order. So I take it you remember, and you're an avid viewer, when the Hinchcliffe years were on your TV.
I was exactly the right age for Hinchcliffe and Holmes to be on telly. Exactly the right age. I think it was 75, 76, so I'd have been seven, eight, nine through to Talons, I think.
Yeah. Into Seeds of Doom first. So I take it you were just the right age for Philip Hinchcliffe when it was going out on TV.
Oh, yes, absolutely. About 7 or 8, I think it was 7, 8, 9 through that Hinchcliffe Holmes era. And I was forever trying to persuade my mum and dad to let me stay up to watch Hammer Films on a Saturday night on BBC Two, and they rarely relented. Every now and again they would. Or what would happen is my mum would say to me, "Dad, right, Leo, he can watch it as long as you stay up and watch it with him. But make sure, you know, if he's falling asleep, bring him to bed. So my mum would then get to bed, and my dad would finish his ciggy, make himself a cup, and then go up to bed himself and leave me downstairs watching it on my own. We completely ignored my mum's orders on that state. Mm-hmm. So I'd then watch Dracula, Prince of Darkness, or The Mummy, or something like that, on my own at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. But yeah, so I think, I can't remember who it was who said it was. Was it Mary Whitehouse who said it was tea time terror for tots?
I think so. Yeah,
that era, and it's that is as much a. That's a mission statement for what Doctor Who should be, in my opinion.
Yeah.
She got it dead right, it was, and it, in no way was that a bad thing. I don't even think they went too far out of the comfort zone with it. I think what they showed was perfectly acceptable for that era and that sort of period of British life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just blissful. I don't think there's a single Hinchcliffe Holmes story that I dislike. I think the weakest is Revenge of the Sidemen, but other than that, they're all. I mean, and the production design and the money on screen it's all up there. It looks superb, and the stories are fantastic. Most of them are based on Gothic literature or old horror films, and they're just I revisit. It is the era I revisit more often on DVD, even though I don't watch Doctor Who as avidly as I did on DVD anymore. I've found that I need to watch more stuff. As I get older, I find I want to watch more stuff and not keep repeating and revisiting what I've already seen.
Yeah,
to broaden my horizons a bit.
You are loud. That's fine. But I'm that little bit younger than you. Hinchcliffe is what I discovered, and I feel like I have seen it, but I can't. I must have been so young when it went out.
Mm.
But that's the era that really resonates with me.
Yeah, it's just
that is the Tom Baker years, and I always sort of forget about the later years when it got a bit panto and everything was falling apart. And
yeah,
and obviously still good stuff going on, but I'd have been quite. I always joke that I'd be quite happy if Doctor Who got cancelled.
Yeah, after
season
Wen Chang.
Basically, yeah, and
it's I find it's certainly my opinion, and it is only my opinion, that Doctor Who is brilliant in short bursts, and the rest of the time, I mean, it's unique and it's mad and it's crazy and it's full of ideas, but it has peaks and troughs, which I suppose any long-running TV series has, but I mean, the lows can be pretty bad, but the heights are just as good as it gets.
Mm.
So you do have spikes in popularity and quality, and never more so exemplified than during the 80s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, yeah, I mean, it's called the Golden Age for a reason, because I think most people would regard it as, you know, just the pinnacle of the show. I mean, I've liked a lot of what Russell T Davies did when he brought the show back.
Mm-hmm.
There are some absolutely stonking episodes and seasons. But even then, you know, even with the production standards of today and the money that, you know, has obviously been lavished on it, in comparison to the earlier sort of seasons, you know, it still stands, you know, it either stands or fails on its writing and its, on the atmosphere and the ideas.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, I agree. I mean, it was never quite the same after Hinchcliffe and Holmes went, you know, moments of flashes of genius aside, but yeah, that's my main. That's what brought me to the show.
Yeah.
And made me a lifelong fan, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Although your next two choices are post-Hinchcliffe. So,
Seeds of Doom. Yeah, Seeds of Doom is a...
But Seeds of Doom is... when I ran a Q&A with Hinchcliffe in Manchester a few years back, and it was just, it was, he hadn't heard until I told him that Stephen Moffat had used his name as a sort of writing aid to one of his writers. He'd said Hinchcliffe the shit out of it.
That's right, yeah.
And so yeah, so Hinchcliffe was very flattered. And obviously and then with Chris Chibnall had dinner with him before launching into his era that's just about to finish, or was probably finished at the time.
Well, yeah,
that finished the other day. But it's strange as well because Tony Beckley Hinchcliffe seemed to specialise in getting really good actors to do really good turns that the actors would really enjoy, which sort of made up for a lot of the fact that, you know, we don't have that much special effects budget, but the script's going to be good and the actors doing the script are going to hold the audience's attention.
Yeah, the villains.
And Tony, the villains quite often. But Tony Beckley, he didn't know Tony Beckley had been in Italian Job, for instance. Till I told him. So just, you know, the casting was done very quickly in those days. And as Gareth has said, BBC didn't have a casting pool in the same way as Granada and other ITV channels did.
No.
So the directors had to get in who they knew. So if you were young, it was quick, get spotlight.
Yeah, that's right. Now it's
and you forget how young Hinchcliffe was.
Nowadays.
Oh yeah, yeah. But Tony Beckley is just phenomenal in this.
He's brilliant in it.
And that bit with the music.
Yeah.
Is just the
well, where he's playing on his organ.
Yeah, yeah.
On his organ.
He's playing on his organ.
Yeah. I can't remember what it's called. Linnaeus. Requiem for Linnaeus or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just he's a proper Bond villain. He's like a low rent Bond villain.
Yeah.
But he's so brilliantly directed as well that whenever I think of the Seeds of Doom, I see that profile shot of him on the floor communing with the plants, with Jeffrey Bergen's eerie music playing over, and it's absolutely terrifying.
Mm.
He is a terrifying villain. I like the way he never takes his gloves off either. He's always
a
fastidious character.
No. Yes. So good.
And I know that people say Robert Banks Stewart just wrote Avengers episodes with and plonked them in Doctor Who in them. People seem to take offence to the Doctor calling Sarah Jane his best friend, which I don't understand. Why wouldn't he? She was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't see that as a kind of Avengerish thing for him to have said.
No.
But Camfield's direction is just incredible, and the music. I like the fact that Camfield got away from the house style of Dudley Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
I love Bergen's scores for Zygons and Seeds of Doom. They're brilliant. I've got the CD. I loved his scores for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the Ghost Stories for Christmas. He did a Ghost Story for Christmas, and his music creates an atmosphere all on its own, but when it's married to really good performances and a nice bit of location filming and a great just stunning direction, then there's, you know, what more can you ask for? And Seeds is definitely my number one favourite Doctor Who story of all time. Primarily because I saw that. I distinctly remember watching it, and at the time it went out, and really wanting to, you know, not being able to wait for the next episode. It's so well done, and it's horrifying. It's a terrifying story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's got, you know, it's got the sort of alien egg type thing, but before Alien came out.
Yeah, it looks exactly like the alien egg with that sort of split at the top. It's sort of oozing. And so using kind of green slime as well for it.
And obviously John Challis.
Yeah.
Before he became really famous with Only Fools.
Yeah.
Just as I'm going to say Scobie. Is he called Scobie? Very menacing.
Scobie,
yeah. Very menacing henchman. He's got so many. I mean, it really is one of the, for my money, it's one of the most watchable, one of the most watchable Doctor Who's ever.
You've got the poor bloke who gets sacrificed to it. Well, he doesn't get sacrificed. He gets attacked by the pod as the Doctor rescues Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And he just gets strapped to a bed and fed meat by the butler. Which is just like, I can't imagine a TV show going out at 5:30, 6 o'clock on a Saturday night that'd have anything like that in it. It's nowadays, it's just insanely, I mean, it's post-Watershed stuff now, that.
It probably would be, yeah.
But it's just, you know, he's licking his lips at a plate of raw meat that's left by the side of his bed. Well, he's strapped to it, turning green with tentacles coming out of his head.
Yeah.
It's just magnificent.
There, they're probably just there going, oh, this is going to be good, because Mary Whitehouse is going to give us lots of free publicity.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely amazing. So, obviously, Hinchcliffe then gets the boot in a crime, and Graham Williams takes over, which I mean, and also the pound crashes. It being
ringing any bells?
No, yeah. Yeah. Well, let's see. Doctor Who is hopefully not going to suffer from the pound crashing.
Yeah.
Seeing it's lots of American money.
Yes,
pouring into it at the moment, but yeah, so you know, little mercies, the Graham Williams era, which, like yourself, the following season after Hinchcliffe's, we do get Horror of Fang Rock, which I always have on my list because it's one of the first one of my first memories is screaming up the route the route and going up the side of the lighthouse,
yeah.
And basically, these are all ones that were commissioned by Hinchcliffe anyway.
Yeah.
So in my head, they're Hinchcliffe.
Yeah, well, Bob Holmes said to...
They're Hinchcliffe on not quite as much money.
Yes, yeah, that's
basically
right.
Basically what they are.
I mean, if you had to choose your favourite Doctor Who story by the amount of times you've watched it, or you've had a couple of beers and thought, what can I watch now at 11 o'clock at night? And you put a DVD on. My favourite story would be Horror of Fang Rock. It's not a Seeds of Doom, as I've just established, but I've watched Horror of Fang Rock is my go-to comfort TV viewing in terms of Doctor Who. I can watch it on a loop almost. It's an absolute masterclass in scripting based on what Holmes asked Tempestix to come up with. It could be done. I mean, it could quite easily be done as a stage play. You know, you could mount that as a really good, atmospheric, terrifying stage play with not many changes. It's you know, it's a classic base under siege, which we kind of hadn't had for a while. You know, they were prevalent during the Troughton era. I love season 5 as well. So I know people think they're all a bit samey, but I just love season 5.
I love Base Under Siege.
Yeah, it's great. Even Space 1999, when that does a Base Under Siege story, it's great. You know, you can't really go wrong with it. But Horror Fang Rock it's brilliantly designed. It's superbly scripted. Tom is never better. I mean, the bit where there's a scene where he jumps up and says, "We haven't been introduced," and then everyone starts introducing themselves, and he just slumps back again, bored out of his skull. just not even interested in listening to what they're saying anymore.
Yeah.
And they're just such a great cast of characters. I mean, Palmerdale and Skinsale discuss, you know, Prime Minister Bonalore, and it's just, the script is absolutely stunning.
Yeah,
and it gets from A to B, episode 1 to episode 4, with absolute efficiency.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, for people of a certain age, it is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, oh no,
obviously,
well,
yourself, Ian.
Yes, yeah. Well, I don't think it's my first ever one I watched, because I remember being, I'm going to have to be careful how many times I tell this to people, and like, it'll end up on too many podcasts. But I remember being scared of going in our downstairs toilet because during the daytime, not at the night, because the sun, we had orange 70s curtains.
Yeah.
You know, rough material.
Yeah.
And the sun shone through, and that made me think of the Zygon spaceship. So I wouldn't go in.
Right, yeah.
So that's before.
Yeah, yeah.
So, so for 8 years I used to say my first memory is the routine going up the side of the lighthouse, and then someone pointed out. Yeah. Well, that was after. But anyway, I have a really strong memory of being with my mum and dad, my brother being in bed, and I used to watch it, not from behind a sofa, but from behind a pillow on the sofa.
Yeah.
Like a massive pillow. And they were sort of monitoring my reaction to it because I was desperate. Yeah, I was desperate to watch it. I was desperate to watch it, and I'd obviously watched it before and loved it. And my dad, oh, he wasn't a Doctor Who fan, but he'd worked on it briefly, so it was
part of the.
It was part of the furniture, you know. In his training as a film editor, he made the TARDIS disappear.
Yeah,
which is kind of a rite of passage for everybody without getting a credit. But anyway, so Doctor Who was always part of. I can't remember a time without it.
Mm.
But I just remember watching it and then the rooting going up the side of the lighthouse, and I screamed and I threw the cushion at the TV. And then my dad started chortling, and I remember him going, "Oh, like this is quite cute." And then my mum going, "Right, that's enough," and storming across, turning the TV off.
Oh my lord.
And then I screamed so loud, my dad went, "Turn it back on!" And then she turned it back on. And
so
then,
you weren't banned from watching it?
No, she tried to, and then I was so distraught that she turned it off, that they turned it back on, and my mum went, "Well, I'm not having anything to do with this," leaving the room.
I know
and
people.
So I sat and watched it with my dad.
I do know people who've been banned from watching it halfway through a story, which is probably the most traumatic thing to do to a kid.
Oh, God.
You're better off letting it play out and let the Doctor win the day.
Yeah.
Just at the end of an episode, all of a sudden, there's something horrible happens that traumatises the kid, and then it's like, you're not going to see how that ends.
Yeah. Don't you know, next week there's going to be a pat resolution to that cliffhanger.
Yeah.
That undermines it completely. Yeah, so horror, fang rock. I also think a massive part, and this is again another thing that Hinchcliffe brought in, was Leela as a companion.
Oh, yeah.
Like we were saying about Liz Shaw before, I think Liz Shaw is a lot better designed than I think Tevens and Barry gave themselves credit for. But Leela is perfectly designed as a companion, I think.
Yeah. Oh, she's fantastic. Yeah.
Here comes your dog.
She's kind of rounded already. She's, you know, she's got so many character traits embedded into her by Chris Boucher.
Mm-hmm.
From the offset, and the stories that she's put in, she's utilised really well. The Robots of Death, where she's perceptive about what the robots are, you know, creepy mechanical men.
Mm-hmm.
She knows that there's no kind of physical or emotional bond between humans and robots, purely on an instinct, even though she's never met a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously in the Pygmalion aspect of Talons of Wang Chiang, the thinking about how she reacts in these situations, she's not just a cipher
mm-hmm.
or a foil to the Doctor. And you get that brilliant, also in Robots of Death, you get that brilliant encapsulation of why the TARDIS is bigger on the inside than the outside, which is as good a description of why that is as anything that's been in the show.
Yeah, I think Louise Jameson says that's her favourite scene of all time.
Yeah,
that she did. But I mean, a lot of the success of Hello Indiana, hope you get a lot of the success of Leela is Louise Jameson as well.
Oh yeah,
because she is such a amazingly good actor, and she could take on Tom Baker as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, so they didn't... They're best of mates now, but at the time they weren't getting on. But I think some people say, oh, I can't watch that because Tom can't look her in the eye and things like that. And I'm like, well, I've never seen that.
No, I don't.
I think they're both acting really, really well.
Yeah.
And she brings out the best in him because she's acting at 100%, and so is he.
Yeah, I've never watched it and thought that these two aren't getting on.
No.
I mean, you can kind of see it a bit in with Tom and Lala a bit. You can tell when they've had a row.
but again, that was when the show was, you know, was slightly falling apart.
Yes.
With budgets and stress and all that sort of stuff. But this era,
before
Louise left, it's still, you know, money's about to run out. But they've still got a good bank of scripts, and it's still the show it was. It's just it's. I guess the decline happens in this season.
Mm. Yeah,
Much as I like Sontar and Zon Gallifrey and all that sort of stuff.
But, yeah, the ideas are great. The concept and the execution isn't so good. I mean, the same with Image of the Fendal, which is brilliant, but the Fendal itself just looks a bit eggy.
Yeah, and again, I mean, Fendal's another example. I love, that's one of my favourites.
I mean,
as well.
The script is, that's another script that's amazing. And it is, I mean, I love it.
That was one of Gareth's choices.
Yeah.
Gareth Cavanagh's choices, so it was, you know, and that's probably would make it onto my list as well. Yeah. That's that era where you've got, it's a Hinchcliffe and a Williams season.
Yeah, sure. I mean, The Sunmakers is far more of a Williams story to me in that season.
Mm.
Because it kind of, the thing with the Williams era for me is that it started looking a bit Blake 7. Everything was filmed in an old power station or something. You know, in things like not Androids of Tara, what's the one that's, Pirate Planet.
Yeah, yeah.
You keep expecting to see Blake and Avon come running around the corner in the background and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It kind of has that, the BBC sci-fi house style at the time kind of bleed into each other.
Well, they did basically have a big dressing up box of sci-fi, so that's why you get Seals of Rassilon popping up in Blake 7.
Yeah, and things like that. You know, an outfit that Avon wears is being worn by a guard in one of Tom's stories, things like that.
Yeah.
So they do start to become interchangeable a bit, and it kind of goes into a direction, the show goes into a direction under Williams that, despite the lack of money, as that's evident as well, it kind of lost me a bit. Probably from The Invisible Enemy, actually. Because I remember going into school the next day and people had started watching something on the other side, whatever was on the other side. It wasn't Buck Rogers, it was something else.
Yeah.
But people would say, oh, you're still watching that? Oh, we're watching this on ITV now.
Yeah. And K9 probably lost as many fans as it,
yeah,
as it gained.
Yeah, I was never really on board with K9, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm of the era that loves me a bit of K9. I do.
I don't mind him, but he's better in some stories than others, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's great in Stones of Blood.
Stones of Blood.
I'm not a mad. I think the key to Time season is the worst Graham Williams season.
Mm.
You know, there's only a couple of stories in that. I like Rebos and I like Stones of Blood, really, and that's probably it.
Not Paracrow.
No.
I can see why people go. That whole era I've got such a soft spot for, again, from pure nostalgia. But when you actually look at stuff, it's the stuff that I don't have nostalgia for, or don't have that much nostalgia, which is the Hinchcliffe era, which I genuinely think raises up.
Yeah.
Because I don't really remember it from Transmission. I just remember Tom Baker, and then you watch him in amazing stories.
Power of Crawl is, I think the actual Crawl monster is great, but you know, like when it's keyed into the
big flat landscape,
into the landscape, it kind of probably the sort of thing they could mess around with on the, you know, the collection sets and make it look really good.
Yeah. No. It's not a perfect. I was on Toby Haydock's podcast. And I chose Power Crawl as my sort of happy times and places, mainly for hovercrafts, which I loved, and then just tentacles wrapping people.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely brilliant. But yeah, so Horror of Fangrock and Leela, and again, did you read a lot of Target novels? I guess the same as I did. I don't want to play with your ball, dog.
It's not a ball; it's a crab apple.
A crab apple.
Let's see if we can get that. Come on.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And issue 3, Omega Eltrella by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
Your final of the TV choices, before we get onto your final choice, which is a comic, is The Marvellous City of Death.
Oh, yes.
Again, Graham Williams era. So,
yeah, I know,
so, it wasn't all bad.
Yeah, I mean, they are the pinnacles, I think, like, of the Williams era. And what's great about City of Death is it's one of the best sitcoms of the 1970s. It's the script is as funny as anything that was written by, Cleese at Fawlty Towers or Porridge or anything. It sings the script. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it is Douglas Adams.
Yeah, and I think Graham Williams has got a lot to do with it as well. I think it shows Graham Williams' flair for comedy.
Yeah.
They locked him in a room with a cold towel around his head and, like, plied him with coffee. Adams, that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Over a weekend to get him to write it. And I think he already reused elements of things, like, as you'd expect from Douglas Adams, I think he reused elements that he already had floating around in his head anyway.
Yeah.
But it's blissful viewing. It really is. The script is peerless. I mean, I keep coming back to the fact that, you know, that the things that I like as I was getting older in terms of Doctor Who is the writing. And earlier in my life, when I was younger, it's that kind of visceral horror of Inferno and Seeds of Doom. So you've got me as a kid. I came for the horror. And I hung around for the clever scripts.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, of Adams and David Fisher and those guys.
Yeah.
I remember
City of Death being it was one of the ones that got the whole family watching.
Yeah.
And obviously people will say that's a lot to do with the ITV strike.
Yeah,
but I don't think it was, because we never watched ITV in our house.
No.
Because my dad worked for the BBC and adverts were evil.
You're quite right.
So we would have been watching it anyway, but the fact is, I remember distinctly it was of a quality where everyone was enjoying it.
Yeah,
like my mum wasn't just knitting and not watching it; everyone was watching it, and so I remember the cliffhanger with Scarlatti taking his mask off and revealing his green alien face. I remember that being a shock to my mum as well as me.
Yeah, well, it would be, wouldn't it? Although you'd have to think, right, well, there's this green alien in the prologue, in the, you know, the start of it, so he's gonna have to turn up again.
Yeah.
But Julian Glover is it's absolutely bang on. He's yet another one of these 70s villains who is just pitch perfect.
Yeah.
And kind of he pitches it absolutely perfectly. He's so good in it. And you get the lovely sets. You've got the brilliant location filming in Paris anyway, but then you've got they've come back to BBC Centre and they've set this, they've struck the sets up, and they look good. They look like Parisian apartments and cellars and what have you. And Duggan's a great, one of the companions that never was, You run out of superlatives for this story, really, because it's so funny.
Yeah, and I don't think it tips over the balance either, which, I mean, I've said elsewhere, I think Douglas Adams loved Doctor Who, but I think his take on Doctor Who maybe didn't always chime with mine. Like his sense of humour that was perfect for Hitchhikers, I absolutely love, I adore Hitchhikers, but tonally, I didn't like it when that tone leached into Doctor Who too much, which it often did. But in this, it's funny and entertaining. It's almost like, I guess, what the modern show is like.
Yes.
Emotionally true and funny, but not too sitcom-y, just, and the adventure is real, the peril is real.
Yeah.
All the elements work.
It is. It just comes together as a great show.
The same team made Horns of Nymon, and it's and it's like, what?
Yeah, it's just that kind of disparate. The massive change between the two. But, you know, that's what we're saying about Doctor Who working fitfully in bouts of brilliance and really, you know, low drama.
Yeah.
But the thing with City of Death as well, like you say, it is a bit of a template for what we get in the modern show, because some of certainly Russell T Davies and Stephen Moffat know how to make a crack a gag in a show. They know how to, you know, tickle the funny bone.
Too often.
Knockabout sometimes. I think...
Occasionally.
Stephen Moffat's slightly more cerebral. I think Russell's gags are pretty good, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Sight gags and written gags are brilliant. I think there's a bit in Partners in Crime when they're talking to each other through the glass doors.
It's just
brilliant.
Yeah.
You know,
I love
all that kind of stuff.
I love Russell T Davies as hero.
But yeah, that kind of... I don't think Doctor Who had had a straight out... I mean, people say that the Romans is a comedy, but I mean, it's not really, is it?
I can't say I've ever seen it.
It's a comedy and kind of carry-on type comedy, but... City of Death is the first time Doctor Who did a show where it was soaringly witty and comedic, I think.
Yeah.
I can't think of one beforehand, really, that is pitched at that level.
No. It's a subtle shift in tone that really works.
Mm. And like you say,
if they'd left the dial there, then it would have been, a lot better. But for what various reasons, I don't know. I always think Nightmare on Eden has got sort of similar elements, but the effects are really leaving it.
Yeah, it's just
letting it down.
It's a shame about the mandrels, really, because when I was a kid, I was getting slightly older by this point, edging towards my teens, I think, 79, was it? So I'd be 11. And I liked the mandrels at the time, but obviously they look ridiculous now. But they look great in the jungle. They look brilliant in the jungle. It's just when they're flapping about the
sets. Yeah, with the sequins visible.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, we've inadvertently done set up a perfect segue for talking about comic books, because obviously Nightmare on Eden is when you and me first worked on
a comic together for
Demons of Eden for Cutaway.
Yes.
In which we weren't allowed to draw mandrels,
except sadly.
Because much as we don't like their design, we're not allowed to replicate it.
The thing is with ropey monsters from Doctor Who, though, and transferring them to comics, is that you can really make them terrifying. Mm. I mean, I'd love to do a big drawing of a mandrel and make it look, you know, bedwettingly scary.
Yeah.
Well, the elements are there. It's just you've got to push it a bit.
Well, I've got an eagle moss sculpture of a mandrel, and it looks good.
Yeah.
It's just on the actual TV show, they were made by the costume department.
That's right.
And so they literally got sequins for scales.
Yes.
And you can see the zip up the back.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's not Doctor Who's finest hour.
I mean, if they...
But I remember watching it and pooing my pants because I was the right age.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if they'd have shot them from the knees up and not made their arms... kind of I don't know why their arms are like just stiff clubs. They haven't got a bend at the elbow. It's weird.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah.
But revisiting that world away from the limitations of TV, Bob Baker's great sort of imagination. Obviously, Demons of Eden, which I was lucky enough to get you as an artist on, was a sort of one of the early cutaway things. It's absolutely brilliant, but obviously that was amongst my first credit as a writer on comic book, but wasn't your first rodeo at all when it comes to comics. So I mean, let's go back for this final segment to the mists of time. When did what was presumably a hobby turn into a job, and how come so much of it, I mean, maybe you can say how much of it isn't, but how much of it is Doctor Who related?
Well, my comic career is nearly all Doctor Who related. Have I done any comics other than Doctor Who? Nothing springs to mind. I did a comic. Well, I went to I went down to London because I had friends who had who were working on a comic for Marvel UK that was called Overkill. That didn't last very long, sadly. Mm-hmm. It was an anthology comic. And John Freeman, who was the...
That was trying to do a 2000 AD type thing.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. Very much so, I think. And John Freeman, who was the editor of that title, I think, was leaving. He was having a leaving do. And I kind of just jumped on the bandwagon of nipping down to London with my two friends who were already working, had work for Marvel, and going to the party, as it were. I'd met John previously at comic conventions in London. I'd been to a couple of comic conventions. So we went down and we had a few beers, and Gary Russell worked there at the time, and I'd taken some artwork, and he saw it, and Paul Neary saw it as well. He was a head honcho at the time there, and he had a look, and he said, "Oh, do you want to do a Doctor Who comic?" I said, "Oh, very much so, yeah." It was completely out of the blue, and it was that informal. It was that kind of, we were just having a pint in the pub round the corner from Arundel House, where the offices were, and they saw me work and said, "Oh, you'd be a good fit for Doctor Who." And Gary had Scott Gray in mind for a Second Doctor story with the Daleks in a summer special. So a few weeks after that meeting, I got sent the script and did that, and gradually more and more work started coming my way. And then when Gary Gillett took over the reins of editor at Doctor Who magazine, he wanted to get back into the sort of era of Doctor Who comics that he'd grown up with, where they had one writer, one artist, a kind of almost story arc, overarching plot. And he chose me to be artist. There goes Indy. Sorry, listeners. he chose me to be the chief artist on that title.
What year was this roundabout?
The first comic was 93. That was the mm-hmm. Bringer of Darkness, the Dalek comic with Scott Gray.
Yeah.
The summer special, 93. And then I think I started... it must have been 94... I started doing the past Doctor stories, and then they kept me on for the Eighth Doctor, the Paul McGann stories after the TV movie had come out.
Because you've sort of famously drawn nearly every Doctor up to McGann, haven't you? Including McGann.
Yes, I think I've only drawn Colin Baker as in flashbacks and Pertwee as well, but pretty much everyone else, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that kept me... going for quite a while.
I was going to say, looking at your Wikipedia credits, that's years of regular employment.
I know,
on Doctor Who comic.
And I was very glad of it, even though it was absolutely backbreaking at times, because I had a full time job as well at the time. I was going into the office every day of the week,
And
then having to do the comic in the evenings till the small hours and at weekends. But I love doing it. You know, I mean. Wow. Like all things, you eventually, you know, you do think, oh man, I really could do with a break from this. This is killing me off.
Yeah.
But then you get a new, you know, a fresh sort of a new lease of life on it. And, you know, you get a new story, a new script comes in, and you're enervated again. You know, you kind of, your enthusiasm ramps up again.
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, Going from drawing Doctor Who as a hobby, which is what I did, to drawing it professionally was a real it was a great opportunity, and I loved doing it, and I still like doing it. Like, I like doing the cutaway stuff now, which is sort of in parallel with as Gareth and yourself say, it's in a Doctorless universe. So
yeah,
they are spin-offs of properties and characters that we're aware of in the Doctor Who universe.
Yeah.
So that's almost more interesting, to be able to explore that without having to shoehorn the Doctor in. And you can do things that you wouldn't be allowed to do in Doctor Who magazine now because of brand guidelines and BBC approval and all the rest of it.
We're keeping it just on. I always think Doctor Who shouldn't go, anything in the Whoiverse shouldn't really go past certificate 12.
No, not like the new adventures then.
I think, much as I like a lot of Torchwood, I also think that tonally was a bit, well, if a five-year-old who can watch 12 certificate stuff can't really watch this, then it's part of the Whoiverse they can't access.
And it was kind of weird as well, because it was a very silly programme aimed at adults. So it's like, I think...
It's much better when they settle down and, you know, like, when it really comes into its own, when it's the Children of Earth.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
That's solid Certificate 12 dark, but kids can watch it and be scared.
Absolutely,
That's where Doctor Who should always be. Or a bit even more child friendly.
Yeah, never too child friendly. Children of Earth was
brilliant.
Stripped over the week, wasn't it? And everyone was talking about it.
Oh yeah, it was brilliant.
From it being a kind of niche BBC Two show, all that Doctor Who spin off with John Barrowman in.
Yeah.
To it being event TV.
Yeah, yeah. There's just something just so right about it. I've watched that so many times.
It's great. It really is good.
Really
and
stands
Peter Capaldi's brilliant. He's,
oh, yeah.
Goes and kills his kids.
And he's called Frobisher to bring us back to comic books.
Yeah.
There's a little nod.
Yeah.
A little
Must
nod
have been
to.
A nod.
A little. Have you ever had to draw Frobisher? The penguin? Shape changer?
Have I ever had to draw Frobisher?
This is a sign of a man who's drawn a lot of comic strips you don't know.
No, I did draw some penguins in the Antarctic.
Mm.
Are they even... penguins are only in one pole, aren't they?
They're in the Antarctic, yeah.
Right, yeah, so I did some penguins in a story, a David Tennant story, but they were just background extras.
Oh, right.
I don't think you've ever drawn Frobisher,
no? No. Yeah. Hey, Indiana. Barking at your neighbours. So I guess your final choice then is Tides of Time / Stockbridge, which is a comic what you didn't draw.
No, what I didn't draw, yeah.
Which is, why is that your choice?
Well, it's Dave Gibbons had been drawing the comic strip for Doctor Who Weekly from its inception, and he'd done the brilliant Iron Legion, which is kind of...
Yeah.
Everyone knows the Iron Legion now, because I think it's due to be reprinted again, I think. So, it must be. It must have been about 2 years since it was last reprinted, so I'm sure it's way out again.
Yeah.
Just a brilliant story. And it was after the kind of slight, and not particularly Doctor Who-ish stories that had been in TV, comic and Countdown and what have you. The Countdown ones, the Pertwee ones are much better than the TV comic ones, I think. There was when Marvel got the rights to it, and we had, you know, proper writers who were kind of familiar with Doctor Who and artists who were at the peak of the popularity and were really, you know, Gibbons had been working on AD and he's penmanship and brushmanship on the early Doctor Who stories on his entire run in Doctor Who, just brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think the pinnacle of that is Tides of Time. I know lots of people like, you know, the Iron Legion.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Dalek one and the End of the Line. It's quite a bleak story, but Tides of Time was a real breath of fresh air. We had Peter Davison on TV, so he was the first actor to play the Doctor in 7 years. You know, that felt like a new beginning. We had a relatively new producer, a whole new cast, and then the comic strip came in. I think it came in infamously on the cover that said Peter Davison is the Doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so he spells his name on. And I just remember reading that first episode of Tides of Time and thinking, wow, this is brilliant. There's that lovely opening shot of Stockbridge, the village, you know, the idyllic quintessential English village that the Doctor would go back to quite often in the comic strip. And it's just, it's a great setting. The villain's good, the villain's pure comic strip, malevolent, not malevolent, but he's kind of like a, He's like a dragon-y demon type chap. And the design work is brilliant, and it's pure Gibbons. It's just lovely. And then it kind of segues into other Stockbridge stories. You know, you've got Max Edison, who's a great invention of Steve Parkhouse. And then it segues into other Stockbridge stories that have been drawn by subsequent artists, myself included. And I remember it being quite a privilege and a joy to go back to Stockbridge to do the first Paul McGann story where he's against the Celestial Toymaker.
Oh, well, yeah.
And it felt like it was revisiting an older era of the show, let alone the comic.
Yeah.
It almost felt like it was knitted into the fabric of the show by this point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, didn't Steve Dillon draw some as well?
He did. He did some later on, some more Peter Davison's with Gus, the American GI or Marine or something on the Pacific Island. Or he certainly travels with him. Did Absalom Dark, didn't he?
Oh, well, of course, yeah. Because this era of comics is one that I'm yet to investigate. I mean,
they're all out there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I may go on eBay, or see if they're on where I can purchase them. But yeah, yeah. But just fairly recently reading your work with on the Flood and all that era of Paul McGann.
Oh yeah.
Because I think in that era I was basically at university, not really spending very much time thinking about Doctor Who or comics, and not having the money anyway, apart from the occasional splurge on VHSs.
Yeah.
Which was in my first year. I strangely didn't buy any after that.
With your grant.
Yeah.
Burnt your grant out on VHS.
Yeah. But then didn't buy them after that.
This was in the days, kids, when you got given a grant and you didn't have to pay it back.
Well, I'm afraid I was in the era where you didn't get
it. Oh, were you?
Yeah, yeah.
So I got a grant and didn't have to pay it back.
I remember going to uni and people who were in the third year were like, oh, this is the first summer where we don't get the doll.
Oh, wow.
Because I was like, you got the doll? It's amazing. That's how you change things. You basically have a generation that doesn't know any different.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And so you're, well, of course you don't get the doll. You're a student. Students don't get the doll. And then it's like, well, we did last year.
they were halcyon days, they were.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, off the politics. But yeah, so Tides of Time I will have to watch. But just for me, that era is, it kind of brought me into the magazine. Because I was an absolute 2000 AD addict. I was absolutely, that was something I never stopped being into. And so I was very aware that Steve Dillon and Gibbons were art droids from 2000 AD.
Well, Gibbons is brilliant. And you also had Mick McMahon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, of course.
The Celestial Toymaker, which is on a Mississippi steamer.
I always remember Junkyard Demon being one of the big ones with Flotsam and Jetsam, and his Baker was just somehow perfect.
Oh,
big, lanky,
absolutely
big, lanky,
nailed. Yeah,
yeah.
Those his massive feet. He had his boots. You know, he had his boots on. Didn't he, with huge feet.
Yeah,
it just looks. It is perfect. You can tell he didn't use a single piece of photo reference. It's all been filtered through his own imagination, and it's hit the page, and it's exactly as you'd expect it to be from a McMahon doctor.
Yeah, it feels like Tom Baker rather than looks like him.
Yes.
Which is what you want from art.
And Michael Gough's Toymaker as well looks like Michael Gough without it being Michael Gough. It looks like it is the Toymaker.
Yeah.
It's just so lovely, you know, boundary-pushing stuff in terms of comics.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What an age.
Yeah.
So, what's... I know what's next for you, but for the... Before we wrap up, next for you in the comic book world, we've got, I mean, have you finished doing Faustine? Steve Gallagher's Thalel universe, which I'm getting to write the characters that come after.
Right, I've started page 41 and looking at the script, there's 46 pages.
So you're nearly there.
So I'm not far off. It's been a long haul.
What I've seen just looks amazing.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And it's obviously I'm inking this one as well as penciling it. So I can be looser with the pencils. Because when I'm penciling for another inker like David Roach, who I penciled for on Doctor Who, you have to kind of be really tight and specific with the pencils, and it kind of, I think keeping my pencils loose because I'm inking it myself allows it to be a slightly more freer expression of line work, really. And it, oddly, it's almost quicker because I'm not having to be so restrictive and prescriptive in the pencils. I can just sort of do quite loose pencils and then ink over. So that's been, it's been really nice to go back to inking. Obviously, I inked Demons of Eden as well. So it's been quite nice to go back to inking after, a, you know, 20-odd years of having someone else do it for me. Because I know what I want. Not that the inkers I had before didn't know what I wanted. They were all brilliant at what they did and did great work on my pencils. But yes, but Faustine is very, very, very nearly there. And yeah, we'll just see where we go after that.
It's all going to be out there fairly soon, I think.
Yes, well, that's the plan.
Yeah.
Like I say, it's been a long time coming, and it has, various factors have got in the way of me getting on top of it and finishing it quicker, but you know, we're not far off.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's going to be absolutely amazing. And like I said, Stephen's, I'm hopefully interviewing Stephen for one of these as well.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Steve's he's such good value.
Well, we had a great time in LA together, didn't we?
We did.
Having
one of my favourite, that's going to be one of my memories for the rest of my life.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's a shame you went. Yeah, well, it's a shame you went a day early because
I know you're telling me.
Having the Steve Gallagher guide to LA was where he used to live was absolutely brilliant.
I really wish I'd have hung around for that, but it was, what was that? What was the name of that horrendous storm that hit Britain that was coincided with us coming back? And I just avoided.
Everyone was watching planes landing on YouTube, weren't they?
Yeah.
While we were in LA.
I just avoided all of that and got home fairly scot-free, and then everyone who came after me was, you know, late and delayed and postponed and sleeping in airports and all sorts.
Well, Gareth and I decided to accidentally missed all that by missing our flight.
spending
hundreds of pounds extra. And but then when we got home, we were like, hey, we've got to hang out in LA a bit longer.
Yeah.
And I think we probably, because the flights we'd missed, the connecting flight, we would have been stuck in Paris.
Yeah, you would have done.
Because they cancelled it while I was in LA going, oh, you know that flight that we were due to go and connect us to get back home? It's been cancelled anyway. So,
well, I'd very much like to.
Now we're at a distance from the cost.
Yeah,
no, that it cost us.
It's a life memory now, which is.
Now it's, but it's cool. It's cool. But anyway, we're probably now going to fade out here. And if, as I say to Martin Geraghty, artist extraordinaire, part of the Cutaway Gang, thank you and enjoy your time in the bunker.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. And apologies to Indy, everyone.
I know. Well, at least he's barked to prove he is a dog, not just a scrabbling rat on your kitchen floor. The sound of his little claws everywhere.
Pattering away.
Yeah.
Soundtrack to my life.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter @cutawaycomics.